Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster, Sam Baker. My guest today is the American author and essayist, Lesley Jamieson. Lesley has the kind of CV that makes other writers weep with envy. The memoir of her alcoholism, The Recovering, was a New York Times bestseller, as was her essay collection, The Empathy Exams. That's the tip of the iceberg, but we only have so much time. Often compared to such legends as Joan Didion and Susan Sontag, I mean, no pressure, Lesley has now written Splinters, glorious and heartrending memoir of what it means to be a mother and a daughter, divorce and dating, of learning how to be many women in one, occasionally, or even often, unraveling package.
It was a time in my life that held this radical simultaneity. Like, I was falling in love with my daughter. I was inside of this ongoing process of just feeling awestruck by her, feeling this fierce devotion to her, right alongside this feeling of deep grief about the end of my marriage.
Lesley joined me from home in Brooklyn, wearing her earrings of power, to tell me how her parents' divorce shaped her, why her small daughter forced her to live in the now, and her penchant for an unhappy ending. We also discussed finding the parts of ourselves we don't even know yet, why she's no longer ashamed of her ambition, that perennial discovery of midlife women, how to say no, and why she's happy to live on Planet Women. Let's just start by, can you tell me just where you are?
I'm at home. I'm sitting in the northern part of Brooklyn, right on the East River. So we, you know, smell the kind of vaguely briny, somewhat sulfurous, but always kind of beautiful fumes of the East River. And we look out on the on Manhattan. And I just love being by the water, like having a little bit more of an open horizon. But I'm just in our bedroom where I have a desk for the first time. When I moved in here 2.5 years ago, this was the first time I had had a desk in a place that I had lived in New York City. So after more than a decade, so it felt like a milestone.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's a big moment, isn't it?
And I look out, speaking of objects that hold these superstitions, I look out on our next door neighbor, born and raised on this block. His parents actually were born and raised on this block. And above his garage, he has a storage unit whose windows I look out onto. And there's a little Mr. Potato Head that has been there as longer than I've been there. And I've thought often if it ever went anywhere, it would ruin everything. Like somehow, you know, it's like crucial to the space-time continuum, like staying cohesive in this particular corner of the world.
It's so strange how we bestow kind of odd things with so much more meaning and pressure.
Absolutely.
Are you superstitious?
Sometimes I am. It's, you know, I struggle sometimes with identifying that porous boundary between superstition and obsessive compulsive disorder or something. Yeah. I sometimes need to check things over and over again. But absolutely, there are certain objects. My best friend and I talk about earrings of power, where we'll have certain pairs of earrings in different eras of our lives that are like the earrings that we wear when we need to feel powerful, and we share with each other what that particular totemic pair of earrings is at any given time. And then we'll kind of photograph it when we send them out. So it's actually, there can be something nice about the very private, totally hidden superstition that's available to no one, but it's also kind of fun to have it as a little bit of a joint custody secret.
Are you wearing earrings of power now?
I am wearing some. They're the newest earrings of power in the roster. I actually got these earrings, which I know won't ultimately be visible, but I was a guest teacher at the Institute of American Indian Arts out in New Mexico a couple of weeks ago, which is just an absolutely incredible institution full of such talented students and writers, and just this like really pretty awe-inspiring community. I loved it. But these earrings were made by one of the students there who does a lot of beadwork. So I feel like I'm carrying a little bit. I mean, that's part of what objects can do, right? They let us carry a little bit of places back with us, or communities back with us.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Well, I should tell listeners, you're also wearing a great jumper, which is got a rainbow and a cat on. Is that right? Is it a rainbow? Kind of looks like a rainbow. Myth Muse.
I hope to never know what it means. I don't know.
It seems very appropriate anyway. So did little Leslie always want to be a writer?
You know, I did. I have wanted to be a writer for really truly as long as I can remember, even before I knew actually physically, concretely how to write. There were a few other vocations that sort of jostled their way into the elevator at various moments. Like there was a time I wanted to be a vet and a time I wanted to be a fashion designer. But really, writing has been kind of the spine of it. And I have two older brothers who are quite a bit older, 9 and 10 years older. And I remember wanting to tell stories, but even before I could write them down, I would kind of enlist them. You know, I would say, you have to write down this story for me. So I have these early memories of, you know, dictating to my brothers, making sure they got it absolutely right, you know, and then sometimes they would kind of force an abrupt ending if they had somewhere else to be. Okay, look, the princess is going to die now, you know.
So you say in Splinters, which I'm still digesting. I'm kind of reeling from it. It's amazing and candid. And the stuff you can do with a sentence, honestly, it makes me just want to pack up and go home. So,
well, thank you for that. And reeling is one of the very best words I could imagine to describe the aftermath of the book. So thank you truly for that.
There's a moment where you say, when I was a kid, I liked to write fairy tales with unhappy endings. Did that start when you were getting your bigger brothers to write them down for you? Were you doing it then, or did it come when you became a more cynical adolescent?
Yeah, I think that it's a great question. I think the unhappy endings were there from early on, and probably for a few reasons. Some of them might have been inspired by my brothers and their desire to bring the stories to a close. Yeah. I also wonder if part of it was a kind of sense I had, intuitive or explicit, that summoning unhappy endings would be more interesting or pleasing to them as an early audience, right? That the kind of happy ending was maybe a little bit boring, or a little bit what was expected, or a little bit, you know, what we already saw.
When you're writing, are you thinking about that? Are you thinking about the audience? You know, you're thinking about what their reaction might be, or are you in the moment?
It's a great question. I think never when I'm drafting, never when I'm first, I'm actually not a believer in saying never, because I think I don't fully know myself. And anytime I try to reduce something to always or never, it's almost always not either of those things. But I think my intuitive deep sense is that when I'm drafting, when I'm putting words onto the page, I'm rarely imagining the possible reader of the text for a couple of reasons, both because when it's going well, at least I kind of get to live inside the spell and the world and the rhythms and the texture of the writing itself. And so I'm not trying to kind of hover partway above it, imagining a possible reader. But I think I've also come to really learn that even if I were trying to imagine the possible reaction of a reader or an audience, I couldn't. Like that part of what it means to live in a world with other people is that you actually can't always know what they're going to say or what they're going to think. And that there's a kind of necessary humility in just letting them think what they think, but not pretending to be able to anticipate it beforehand. So I think there's actually would be a kind of futility in trying to imagine too much.
So tell me a bit about Splinter and the decision to write it, really, because it's, you know, it's incredibly personal. Obviously, the recovering was very personal as well. What was it that made you want to document that experience, you know, the divorce, the relationship, the divorce, having your daughter?
The impulse or the idea, the kind of first motivating energy for the book, it began where the book itself actually begins, which isn't always the case. The process of writing a book doesn't always become the literal beginning of the book. But in this case, it did. When my daughter and I, when I first left my marriage, my daughter was just a year old. My daughter and I moved into a small, dim apartment in the middle of winter that was right next to a firehouse. And I still think of it as the firehouse sublet. My friend called it our birth canal. You know, it was sort of a long, dark, womb-like space, but there were always these sirens going by. There were firemen kind of strutting to and fro with their chainsaws. And it was a space it was a time in my life that held this radical simultaneity. Like I was falling in love with my daughter. I was inside of this ongoing process of just feeling awestruck by her, feeling this fierce devotion to her. So that love was really present for me in that time. Right alongside this feeling of deep grief about the end of my marriage. And the impulse to want to make some kind of story about that time in my life really came from the intensity of that simultaneity, this feeling of feeling such love and such grief at the same time. And that was what I wanted to write, the kind of both at once-ness of it. So I started writing these small fragments of prose. I think of them as splinters of prose. In a way, the title of the book is certainly emotional. It's certainly conjuring, you know, experiences, often painful experiences that stay with us. They lodge inside of us. They become part of us. But splinters is also evoking the kind of rhythms of the prose itself. So these small fragments, like a paragraph to a page, that are just these kind of whittled moments of experience. So I started to write some of those and to kind of find the rhythms of the book, maybe. But it was always that investment less in, oh, I want to tell the story of these experiences. And in fact, really most of the narrative of my marriage and even its dissolution is actually not in the book. A reader hopefully feels like they're having a very total experience, which is always what you want to give a reader when you write a book. But most of it isn't there. But the part that is there and the part that I really understand as the kind of beating heart of the book is like, what does it feel like to try to hold two wildly different feelings at the same time? And like, I think everybody has had a version of that, many versions of that. And one of my hopes for the book is that, you know, certainly, you know, that it would resonate with people who are parents or have been married or have been divorced, who share some of those literal experiences, but also that really anybody who's lived some version of like, I'm feeling joy and I'm also feeling impossible grief, that the book, even if they don't share any of the kind of surface of this experience, is that they might share that or feel spoken to by that.
Yeah. And it's also the other, well, there's so many dualities, I suppose, going on, because there's the kind of the guilt that so many women feel about working and going back to work and wanting to work, wanting their working self back, you know, the joy at doing it and the guilt at doing it and wanting to do it, which comes through really clearly. Can we go, I think in order to explain some of it, it would be helpful to go back and look at maybe your parents' divorce, because it's your parents' divorce runs through the book and it also seems to be really pivotal to your approach to relationships and marriage. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about it, because I think on a process level, the role that my parents and their marriage and divorce ended up playing in this story surprised me a bit. Like, there's always, when you sit down to work on a project, at least for me, there's the stuff I know I want to write about. And then there's all the stuff that's going to ambush me and kind of come in from the side and become part of the story I'm telling, even if I didn't understand that at the outset. And as I really tried to dig as deeply as I could into my own ideas about marriage and commitment and when it might be the right time to leave a marriage, I realized there's no way I can tell the version of this story that I want to tell without turning back towards the story of marriage and the model of marriage that I had grown up with, which was, you know, my parents. And this, their story is, you know, they were married for 22 years. They have 3 kids and they shared a life. And they did have quite a painful divorce, but to me, the most interesting and certainly one of the most beautiful parts of their story is that about a decade into their divorce, they really were able to rebuild quite a close friendship, which has now been part of their lives for 2 decades. And that friendship, which feels very much like different from any other kind of friendship, it's a friendship that holds the fact that they once were married and are no longer married. They share 3 children. They share many memories, but they also share many memories from their post-married life. And so there's this way that part of what their marriage and divorce taught me was that divorce isn't an ending. It's the beginning of whatever's next. And that whatever's next isn't always a beautiful friendship. Sometimes it's something else. But that there is an aftermath. And this question of what you do with the aftermath isn't a closed question. It's a question that can take you to many places. So I love that about them. For example, my dad has been married 3 times. And my mother actually officiated his third. My mother's an Episcopal deacon. Anglican deacon, and she officiated his 3rd marriage. And people always love this. It's like, oh my God, your mom officiated your dad's 3rd marriage. And I think there's something beautiful about it too. But, you know, years after it happened, my mother also said to me one day, you know, I think it might have been a bit much to do that. And I quote, she has so many great lines in the book, and she's really the hero of the book. My mother's amazing. And I like to give her these good lines, because she's often a bit of a force that's like, maybe you could say, bringing me back from the narrative or the story of experience into the texture of experience, or kind of a certain reality of experience. And so, but I also liked that observation from her, because it pushed back a little bit against offering kind of a vision of their post-divorce bond that was too fully seen through rose-tinted glasses.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Her becoming a deacon, there's a wonderful story in the book about how that happened, about the row that your mother and father had, I think, prior to their divorce, where your mother said, "You don't know me at all." And I just think that will really resonate with so many people, because it was really, that really opened a door, didn't it, for her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she said at that moment, "You don't know me at all. For all you know, I might want to become a priest." And it's an incredible moment. It was an incredible story when she told it to me, because she hadn't ever consciously articulated that to anyone else. And she hadn't even consciously articulated it to herself. And I just thought, what a stunning moment and such an illuminating moment that you could become available to yourself or known to yourself in a different way through the act of argument and through the act specifically of telling somebody, there are parts of me you don't know. And that actually saying that to another person, there are parts of me you don't know, might be the catalyst that allows you to see those parts of yourself. It's like stunning to me. And a really interesting, I think, question to take back. I mean, I hope it resonates with people, because I hope they kind of take that question back into their own lives. Not only what might be illuminating rather than just painful or toxic about certain moments of friction or argument, but also a version of this question that my friend Harriet asks in the book, which is, you know, what are the parts of yourself you don't yet know? And God, what a perpetual question.
Yeah.
You know, what a generative question. What an exciting question. I mean, maybe a terrifying question too, but I think also an exciting question.
And what are the parts of yourself that you don't yet know?
At this current moment, you know, one part of myself that I remain interested in getting to know, like maybe we've met at this point, like we're acquaintances, but we don't yet know each other well, is this part of myself that actually shows up at a moment late in the book when I'm describing a breakup. I'm describing this hedge funder who, you know, in certain ways is quite lovely, has read the book, like everybody in it. But he was breaking up with me on a set of church steps. And kind of after he'd said, you know, this is done, he said, you know, "Can I give you a hug?" And I said, no. And I never say no. I'm such a people pleaser. It's very difficult for me to say no to anyone ever. And I was surprised by it. I felt like I was hearing my own voice, but I hadn't consciously made the choice to say it. And in the book, I say, you know, what little voice inside of me was saying no like that? Like, I wanted to get to know her better. And I still do. Like, that part of me that can say, "I'm sorry, I can't give you exactly what you want," or "I'm going to draw a boundary here," or, you know, "this is for me and that over there is for you." And, you know, all of the, it's like a whole spiritual family of like kind of difficult impulses that have to do with accepting that you're not going to be able to give every single person every single thing that they want. And that part of me that's like, okay with it is interesting to me.
Have you got better at saying no since that moment?
I'd like to say yes. It feels very ragged. It feels very touch and go. Sometimes, you know, I do have, I have a job, which is another place where I'm sort of learning always how to say no. And, you know, I work, so I teach at a Columbia School of the Arts and the writing program, where I've been for about 10 years. And I also direct the nonfiction concentration. So I have a lot of kind of administrative leadership duties in that role. And one thing that I've really learned, although I practice it imperfectly, is that saying yes to everyone, even if you could do it, would always have a cost. Like, and that often it's like, if you let one person have everything they want, it's like at somebody else's expense. And so when I think, not always, but around certain things, and when I think of it that way, that like part of saying no is making room for somebody else's desires, who's maybe a little bit less vocal or a little bit less able to advocate for themselves. Or sometimes saying no is like about making more room for your own desires. And I don't have it anymore, but I should probably bring it back. I used to have a notebook of no's, this thing I call the notebook, talk about totemic objects, where I would write down everything that I had said no to. And then underneath, I would try to write, what is that no making room for? Whether it's like, you know, I'm not going to do this conference, and so that makes more room to spend a Saturday making collages with my daughter or whatever. I'm saying no to this, but really kind of trying to reframe negation as possibility.
That's such a good idea. Because I think so many women have a problem with saying no to things. You know, whether it's professionals, they think if I say no this time, I'll never get asked again. Or whether in their personal lives, where they've just been kind of trained and learned to make room for other people's desires, I guess. I found your relationship with your mum really interesting. And the way it's, you know, like you've said earlier, she is probably, along with your daughter, the hero of the book, actually. I mean, they are both, I mean, if it was fiction, I would say they were both great characters. But and they are both great characters. But also, I was interested in the way your relationship with your mum, your very close relationship with your mum, really shaped your relationship with other women. Mm-hmm. And at one point you talk about living on Planet Women, which I absolutely loved. And I love that sense of you rebuilding that kind of safe place relationship, if you like, that you had when you were growing up with other women throughout your lives.
Yes to everything you said. And it's funny because there's a, you know, when I think about Planet Women, I always in my mind's eye remember both the apartment I was living in at the time, the one with the, you know, the tree and the nail. I remember this particular exhibition that I was going to over and over again at the Brooklyn Museum. I write about it a bit in the book, but this exhibition of the photographer Gary Winogrand's color photographs. And it was, for me, it was like going to church. It was, the exhibit was this long, dark hallway where the color photographs were projected as slides on the wall. And it was just, felt like the church of humanity. Like, these are ordinary people, ordinary moments, and so stunningly beautiful. And it, you know, it felt like a way to kind of let the world get large and rich around my problems, for starters. But there was my favorite bench was at the end of this long, dark hallway in the section called Women. The exhibit was divided into these themed sections. And the women's section was my favorite. It was all photographs of women. And so when I think about Planet Women, I think about going to that exhibit and just surrounding myself with these luminous women projected onto the walls, which was, of course, what I was doing in life as well. I was leaning on my mother. I was surrounding myself with these beautiful friends. Not all of them were women. Actually, when the German translator of the book, at one of their questions was, you know, that some friends in the book are named, others are unnamed. And the German translator said, you know, in German, we have to gender the friend, even if they're unnamed.
Yeah, like French as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are they all women? And it was a really interesting question because I was like, oh, is every friend in here a woman? And the answer, as it turns out, was no. But it was illuminating to me and a bit of a check again on the reductive narrative to know, okay, yeah, actually this one on page 162 is male. And one of the male friends in the book actually is my editor, who's also a close friend of mine. And he has a kind of a piece of wisdom that shows up at a certain point in the book. So, you know, there were a few men on Planet Women and eventually a few kind of lovers on Planet Women. But that sense of kind of finding in women, in other women, in female friendships, a version of the safety, the love, the deep communion that I found with my mother is absolutely a thread. And that sense of kind of, these are people for whom I don't have to perform a certain version of myself. And I say that fully realizing like we're always engaged in some sort of performance and every moment of being in a self and sort of also performing a self. But I think we all also can be real about the fact that sometimes we feel that performance more contortingly than other times. And it's often with women that I feel the fewest contortions and can just kind of be how I am rather than trying to kind of become a certain version of myself.
I think those contortions will ring so familiar with, sorry, mixing my metaphors, with so many women who I think, particularly when you're a younger woman, I certainly felt that, you know, you're always contorting yourself to be into a shape that you think someone else wants you to be, whether they do want you to be or whether it's your assumption because you're being hyper alert is another matter, really. And then you kind of get to, I mean, I think, are you just 40 now?
Yeah.
And you kind of get into your 40s and you start to think, actually, I'm going to stop the contorting. You know, you just kind of reach a point where you just become aware that you do it, I think, and you start to stop doing it. And I see that so often with women that I've interviewed.
Well, I can't wait. I mean, I think I've already inside of that process, but I've had a deep excitement about my 40s for a while now. I felt like, I think this is going to be a great decade because I was a bit of a mess in my 20s. And then my 30s were really a process of trying to figure it out and uprooting and all that. And I was thinking my 40s, like this is right. I know a few things about myself now and have a little bit, you know, got some things figured out, but not everything figured out. So I'm glad to hear this evocation of the 40s is a place where the contortions, maybe you just are tired of them and you stop doing them and it's going to sign me up.
So you talk a few times in the book, but particularly towards the end, about having a tendency to live in the story and not in the texture of the everyday and the texture of the reality, whether that's in a love affair or your relationship with your daughter. I could be like putting two and two together and making 950, but how do you think that that intersects with writing memoir? Do you think that writing memoir might exacerbate that because you're looking at it as a writer?
I don't think you're putting two and two together and making 950, although I love that expression and I'm going to steal it. I think we all live in the story sometimes. I think everybody who is living is also telling themselves not just a story, but a series of stories about their lives. I think it's part of how we make sense of our experience or even how we kind of hold on to the bewilderment of our experience. So I think, you know, when I talk about living in the story rather than the texture of the experience or sort of struggle against that part of myself that maybe is so committed to the story that I forget or don't pay enough attention to, like, what do these days actually feel like? In a way, it's like I'm looking at what I think is a shared human trait, but is maybe kind of become sort of oversized, a kind of tumor in me or something like that. And the dynamic that I'm trying to get at is like, you know, with a relationship, maybe I tell myself a story about, you know, I'm going to kind of save this person from a certain kind of unhappiness. And we're going to be able to build a new life with each other that feels like a kind of salvation from the life before. And I'm so attached to that notion of how things might work out that I'm not paying enough attention to, like, how does it feel to to wake up with this person in the morning? How does it feel? What kind of tension is there at the breakfast table or in bed when we're falling asleep at night? Or how does a kind of resentment crackle like electricity in the air? Because I want so much to believe in this story that I've already told myself about what it can be or how it will be. And I think actually my daughter has been my teacher in so many ways. But one of those ways is that I think she's constantly summoning me away from the story of experience and back into the texture of experience. So, you know, there's a scene in the book. She and I are about to move into a new apartment. I'm kind of noticing outside the window of the living room, there's this big elm tree and there are these little buds. It's like early spring. And I'm thinking, oh, this is like, you know, it's a perfect metaphor. You know, we're in this difficult time, but like we're rebuilding a life and look, like so buds are about to bloom. And like, as I'm having all these metaphoric thoughts about the tree outside the window, my daughter in the meantime has like crawled into the corner and put this like long, inch long nail into her mouth, you know, yes. And it's so actually, sorry, it was a screw, not a nail, but equally frightening. And, yeah. And in that moment, I'm sort of like the moral of the story is forget about the story, you know, just take care of your daughter and not even in self-punishing or punitive ways, but I feel like my daughter is always kind of welcoming me back into the actual and the real and kind of like, I'm using this bowl as a hat, like, I'm delighted by a piece of apple. Like, so, I'm grateful for that. And to your question, yes, I'm sure that the fact that I do often literally turn my life into stories, is in a kind of a feedback loop with how I live. And I think there's a cynical way of regarding or framing that feedback loop, along the lines of, you know, if you make art maybe from your lived experience, are you ever fully living inside your experience? Because you're always somehow anticipating what will this become, you know, what will this become in a piece of writing or something akin to like when you take too many photographs or put too many posts on social media, are you ever inside the thing? Because you're always thinking about documenting the thing and sharing the thing. And I think there is truth in that. I think that imagining the telling or sharing of a thing can kind of take you outside of it. But I don't think it's an unequivocal or wholly bad or like monolithic effect. I think sometimes thinking about how does this moment of experience kind of play into the larger arc of my life, my soul, this relationship, this history. I think sometimes that can actually make you more present rather than less because you're kind of paying attention to it in a different way. I think I'm often quite attached to the sensory particulars of any given moment. And so there's a kind of like radical noticing that I think I do with an increased ferocity because I'm always wanting to be able to remember things in the aftermath. And again, it's neither good nor bad, but I don't think it's necessarily the enemy of presence.
You talk about ambition in such an interesting way. And I think that that kind of idea of, you know, what is ambition? I mean, the fact that ambition tends to be frowned on in women much more than men because it's seen as being at the expense of something else. Whereas on the whole, and I'm generalizing massively, but I am going to generalize for the sake of this. For women, ambition is maybe seen as being at the expense of something more womanly. And for men, it's they're allowed to have it alongside other things. But I was really interested in the idea that you felt like if you'd failed at happiness, then success could be the consolation prize.
Mm. Yeah, I think the book is really reckoning with ambition. And I think part of that reckoning has something to do with, you know, exactly what you're describing. Certainly the way that female ambition is often figured as a kind of zero-sum game where the energy being directed towards a desire to be an artist or have a career or, you know, build a life outside the home is like so much seen as at the expense of what happens in the home, the children and the domestic labor. And that somehow that the tyranny of that zero sum is, it seems like it's almost never applied to men in the same way. So I think I'm in part reckoning with that. How does one kind of stop feeling like not enough in that particular way? There's the moment where I describe having my students over for a class at my home when my daughter was 9 months old. And somehow I had this crazy idea that I was just going to teach the class and she was going to be there and I was going to have all the food ready and it was just all going to work, you know. And in a way it kind of did. Like she was like in her little jumperoo, like this little sort of seat that had these toys attached to it. And so she was sort of sitting in our workshop circle. But I describe in that moment that basically the fantasy of doubling myself, of being like fully mother and fully teacher, and that actually I felt not doubled at all. I felt like half of each, or if that, and certainly not enough of each. And so I definitely wanted to write into the way that gender and ambition have this complicated and often entangled relationship. But I also wanted to write about moments where I felt like I was able to glimpse, either in my own experience or more often through somebody else, an alternative to that kind of zero-sum game, in a sense that like one could actually integrate even a creative life and a maternal life, that these could be forms of energy that fed on each other. And so I write about the artist Leah Lublin, who brought her son brought her infant son into a gallery in Paris, and her installation was sort of taking care of him there. I write about the Crow artist Wendy Redstar, who collaborates quite frequently with her daughter Bee, and in fact traces some of her most compelling artistic ideas to moments with Bee or things that Bee did. And there's a moment that I think about a lot when I think about like what is this book trying to say about ambition, a moment where I describe my first interaction with the woman who would essentially become my boss. She was the dean at the School of the Arts at Columbia for many years. And she's an incredible person. And she so sat me down. It's basically a job interview. And she's like looking through my CV. And she said, you know, you've done a lot of things. And I immediately moved into the deflections. I said, well, I've been so lucky. I've had all this tremendous support, had all these wonderful resources. And she stopped me. She literally interrupted me and said, stop. She was like, I'm sure all of that is true. And also, you've done a lot. She was like, I know exactly what you're doing. She said, I've done it before. I know a lot of women who have done it. You know, this kind of, well, it's actually, I owe it all to this other thing, or haven't really done that much, or here's what's wrong with what I've done. And she was like, you know, you can just own it. And that was an important moment for me. Not that I have become a perfect owner of anything, but that idea that like both the recognition of a certain kind of deflection that was ashamed of ambition, ashamed of pride, ashamed of being seen as being too proud, you know, or too wanting too much, you know, and just even being able to recognize all the parts of myself that kind of rose up conversationally to keep that part of me from view.
Yeah, it's almost like that sense of having to apologize. It's like you don't want to be seen to want it too much, maybe, and having to apologize for wanting it in a way that, again, to generalize, you don't see men do so often. That's so interesting. I could listen to you talk about that all day. I will let you go in a moment. I just want to ask you the questions that I always ask at the end. The first one is, what is your emotional age?
17 for sure. I'm just a big feelings teenager at heart, no matter how old I get. I think I relate to that emotionality differently than I did then, but I really identify. There's so many songs called 17, actually, and I think there's a reason for that. I identify so much with that sense of feeling overwhelmed by emotions. It's like so big. How can the body hold it?
17 is, it's interesting because it's so much on the cusp of something as well. Interesting. Can you give us a book recommendation? So it can be a book that's had a big impact on you through your life, or it can just be a great book that you read recently.
The book that I was thinking of is actually the book that I think of as a kind of godmother text to Splinters, which is Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights. And it's also in its way a powerful kind of document of divorce. It's very opaque. The divorce is not the narrative center, but it's very much written from this state of like a life in rupture. And it's also kind of written in these searing fragments that like look inward and look outward. But I love it. I love it as in a way, the artifact of a soul seen through its perceptions of the city. It's a beautiful document of New York City too.
What advice would you give younger women?
Nourish your friendships. It's been the greatest gift of my adult life, really, having these friendships that have lasted, you know, in certain cases from 11, in other cases from my early 20s, but in so many cases holding now decades and decades of prior selves and memory. And one of the things I love is the way in which I think a good friendship allows you to be continuous and transforming at once. Like a friendship can hold all of these versions of who you've been. So it can kind of hold like your past. But also I think part of what I love in my friendships is that when I'm talking to friends, really close, good friends, I just had a dinner like this with a friend last night. It's like, you can think something new. You can get to know some of those parts of yourself that you don't yet know. So there's this way that it feels safe enough to maybe experiment or transform. And there's something about that continuity and that dynamic quality that feels really special to me.
The combination of being able to just pick up exactly where you left off without explaining, but go someplace new.
Exactly.
Who is an older woman who's inspired you?
I had two answers to this. One of them, I'll just say my mother, who we've already spoken of, but she's always the first. But the other woman I was thinking of is a writer who I've never met. I don't know her at all, but her work feels like it's given me, among other things, a model for what maybe the next stage might look like. And that's Deborah Levy. And her books, I don't know whether you've spoke. I mean, I would love to.
I'm trying. I try so much. And I love The Cost of Living is just, I mean, I love all three of those, but The Cost of Living is so brilliant.
Agreed.
Do you feel like there is a template, more of a template now for what, you know, being a woman looks like in your 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond than maybe there was?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and I'm aware too that I'm sure my search for templates of kind of many ways to be is different than somebody's might have been 30 years ago. So in that sense, I both feel like I don't know exactly what to compare it to and that I'm quite lucky. But I mean, even in my family, I feel like I have these wonderful models, not only what kind of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s can look like, but how these are not just decades of sort of, these are not just fallow decades or decades of even just like following through on the identities that you've already forged. They can really be decades of kind of renewal and reinvention. My mother went to seminary in her 50s, right? She went to seminary the same year that I went to college. So she's certainly a model for sort of how much bigger life can get in those decades as well.
I see that happening more and more, certainly. What's your superpower?
I think my superpower is follow-up questions. I'm a big believer in follow-up questions and I ask them all the time. And I think a great follow-up question, and maybe this is just a really self-ennobling answer, but I think a great follow-up question shows how much you have listened to what has just been said, and also shows how curious you are about what more there might be to say. It just gives the person an invitation and says, you're engaging me, like I'm here with you and I want to know more. And I believe that this back and forth might even be a space where you could say or think something you haven't thought before. And so anyway, I love them.
Honestly, don't get me started on that, because, you know, number of times you hear people interviewing people and they just go through their list.
Yeah.
And someone says something really interesting and they just let it drop and go, and my next question, I'm like, no, you just had this gift. Anyway, last one. How many fucks do you give?
All of them. I think I give them all. Sometimes I fantasize about being a person who gives no fucks, but I love that part of Maggie Smith's memoir. I don't know if you've read it, where she says, I gave all the fucks. And I thought, yeah, I do too.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love Maggie. She came on the podcast as well.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. This was so lovely. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And all the best to you and your family.
And you.
Yeah.
And good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy The Shift and would like to show your appreciation, why not buy me a coffee? Go to www.buymeacoffee.com/The Shift with Sam Baker. You can hear a new episode of The Shift every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please do rate, review, follow, tell your friends, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to know more about my own experience of shifting, my book, The Shift, How I Lost and Found Myself After 40, and You Can Too, is out now in paperback.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.